This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. You're listening to Issues and Ideas, the show where local voices tell the stories that keep the Central Coast connected. I'm David McAbee. On this week's show, Father Ian takes a trip to our global family farm right here in San Luis Obispo. There, he's introduced to regenerative agriculture and permaculture. Then we welcome a new segment to Issues and Ideas, Gianna Patchen with People and the Planet. For her first interview, she talks with the San Luis Obispo Climate Coalition. Finally, I sit down with author, speaker, and advisor Tom Bowman about his new book, What If Solving the Climate Crisis is Simple? We dive deep into his thoughts on the climate issue and the practical steps everyone can take to help. It's permaculture, climate solutions, and fresh ideas for a sustainable future, all coming up on Issues and Ideas.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. Modern agriculture faces challenges like climate change and resource scarcity. Innovative techniques are maximizing productivity while minimizing environmental impact. That's the introduction to permaculture by our global family farm. The farm is a permaculture demonstration farm in a corner of Slow City Farm in San Luis Obispo. I had no idea what permaculture was, so I met up with permaculture design activator Trees Lees to connect, explore, and discover the whole systems thinking practice of permaculture.
Hello, my name's Teresa, or Tree is what my nickname is. And I'm managing a parcel of land out here at City Farm called our Global Family Farm. And I'm doing it in a regenerative way. It's actually in a permaculture way, which is an example of agroforestry or growing trees, which is a food forest.
So what do those two words mean?
Agroforestry, agro means agriculture, and forestry is trees, and you put the two together, and that's what the food forest is. So it has fruit trees, as well as berries and vines and vegetables and herbs and flowers all together.
You said regenerative agriculture and permaculture. What are those?
So regenerative agriculture is the term that's used these days beyond organic and beyond sustainability, which is kind of maintaining or sustaining. But regenerative is we are regenerating the soils and our communities. We're adding back to the community and the soil community as well. So it's a term that's used now across the nation for people that are doing regenerative ag, or people that are minimizing soil disturbance, maintaining living roots, which means leave the roots underground. You can chop off at the ground, but don't dig them up. So we don't use tractors also. So regenerative ag is no-till and leaving the roots in, keep the soil covered, integrate animals, and plant a diverse crops. So how you can get certified organically, you can also get certified regenerative ag.
And then what does the word permaculture mean?
Permaculture is a combination of the two words, permanent and culture. Think of it as indigenous cultures meet modern culture. I focus on the word culture a lot out at Global Family Farm. I call it that because we look at food cultures from around the world. We are inviting multicultural appreciation, cultural diversity, and biodiversity, and to have a world where we care for the earth, we care for people, and we care for our future. That's what permaculture is. It's based on these three ethics. And it also has the basis of ecosystem management. Permanent, meaning you're creating a whole ecosystem that will thrive over a long period of time. And so that's why they use the word permanent. Sustainable is referring more to like it can last and be maintained. But regenerative and permaculture is indefinitely. So it's even longer lasting than organic or sustainable ag.
Can you show me what makes your farm different?
Okay. It's an agriculture ecosystem intended to be sustainable and self-sufficient. So what I'm doing here is like a homesteading. This farm scale is like your home scale. You can have your house surrounded by edible landscaping. So that's really what this amounts to. In the middle, I have like a little shelter that would represent a house. And then around it, we have all the edible plants. We do crop rotation, always putting things in a new spot. We don't grow the same thing over and over and go over in the same spot. We are using a permaculture design, again, called a food forest. And this particular food forest, our global family farm, is based on the four directions. Take the idea of the globe, the four corners of the globe, north, south, east, west. So I created this for children and families and people of all ages to come learn, well, what crops are from north, meaning north continents of Europe, and then east, meaning Asia, and to the south, the continents south of the equator, and then the Americas over here in the west, North, Central, and South America. We do is grow polyculture of crops, means so many things are growing together. Companion planting is another term for it. So we don't have just rows and rows and rows of one thing. We mix it up. And we do a lot of composting. So we have all this plant material, and then we take all that plant material and put it into piles. And then that piles become compost that's returned back to the earth. There's one pile there, and I have other ones as well. We also use the compost from the Compogas Hayashi biodigester from everybody's green waste at the curbside that ends up over here by the airport. There's a big factory, I guess you could call it, where all that goes into and is ground up and it goes in this silo, and then it comes out as finished compost. And we use that compost from the city as well.
I did a radio show on the biodigester. Not this one, but the one in Monterey, because this one wasn't finished yet.
Okay, so you know a bit about it. So they also generate
electricity.
Yeah. So.
Well, methane to generate electricity.
There you go.
Yeah.
He knows what he's talking about, people. That would be an example of regeneration right there.
Okay.
Think of regenerative as recycling and restoring, revitalizing.
So you said you have the four corners of the earth here, and we're standing next to the, what section is this? This is the west?
Okay, so we honor indigenous wisdom. For example, we plant the three sisters. So corn and squash and beans are growing together. And that's a Native American tradition that we're honoring by planting it here.
And when you say together, I'm looking at this, they're not just plots next to each other. The corn and the squash and the beans are integrated all into one, all into one plot.
Yeah, they're intermixed. The beans are starting to climb up the corn stalks. So that's where you have the sisters, the three sisters, meaning that they get along as good companions, as good sisters, being sisterly. The squash, actually, I planted first and it grows outward, then the corn growing upward, and that provides a stalk, a pole for the beans to climb up. They each have their own niche to fill.
This would be how the indigenous of the Americas would have planted their crops?
Yeah, so there's the beans growing up, squash intermixed in between. It's hard to know exactly how they did it, right? So that's kind of why we're experimenting, like, well, let's relearn, you know, what our ancestors did in this lands, learn how they did that. You know, there's ways of growing crops in Hawaii that's different than Mexico. Every culture has different ways of growing.
With the beans and the corn and the squash, how challenging is it going to be at harvest time?
Yeah, it is a little bit of tiptoeing around. I have to be careful that I don't crush things as I walk through each row. It's been said that Native Americans would plant it in a circle and then have a series of circles. And they even would then use a fish underneath in the middle of the circle to bring some nitrogen into the soil. And the beans also bring nitrogen into the soil. There's a term of as below, so above, or vice versa, as above, so below. What that means is whatever you have above ground, you also need to consider what is below the ground to regenerate the soil. So growing the legume, the beans, helps bring nitrogen to the soil to regenerate the soil. Then what I'll do in the wintertime when this crop is done is do the cover cropping and then rotate. Next year we won't do the corn and beans and squash here. We'll rotate it maybe over here where the tomatoes are.
So when you say that you don't dig up the roots, though, do you have volunteers come up the next year?
The only thing that does come back is this red stuff, this amaranth. It's seeds, seed heads. That's an ancient grain, and it repopulates itself every year.
Do you harvest it and use it as grain?
I haven't yet. That's another indigenous or ancient grain practice that we're learning how to do. We do use it in floral displays. You can also eat the leaves, amaranth. Another crop we're learning about is the indigo over here, which is a plant to make blue jeans, indigo, the blue dye. So plants for food, but also plants for medicine, plants for dyes, plants for the pollinators. That's another thing about this ecosystem. You'll see a lot of butterflies flying around, pollinators. So we make a home for them as well out here in the garden.
You're listening to KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm at our Global Family Farm in San Luis Obispo. Trees Lees is teaching me about permaculture, a term coined in the 1970s to describe an integrated, evolving system of perennial or self-perpetuating plant and animal species useful to humans. We just explored the Western Hemisphere section of the farm, and we are now on our way to the European section, but not before we check out the butterfly food.
The milkweed, we do let it also go to seed. Look at that, it looks like cotton in a way. Yeah. Those are all the little seeds, and it's going to spread. And so then you'll see milkweed. So that's food for the butterflies. And then we're sharing the space of the milkweed with a pumpkin patch and a strawberry patch. And then on this side here, the squash has peppers aligning it right next to it. So we're always looking at sharing the space. Again, like the three sisters, the niches in ecosystem, that's a term that's used a lot in ecosystem management, is niches. So what space they take up, what sunshine can shine there, but also provide shade and habitat at the same time.
Can we go to another part of the globe?
Yes.
All right, I'll follow you.
Okay. The jungle out here. We have traveled to Europe now, and we're looking at what's called a guild. In permaculture, you design things together, it's called a guild. We have plum and a plum. And underneath the two fruit trees, we have comfrey. This big leaf plant is a medicinal plant, but it also is a mineral accumulator. The deep roots bring up nutrients and minerals from deep in the soil. We chop and drop all these leaves in the fall. It's like a cover, the soil. We don't really want the sun baking this soil because it'll turn to adobe bricks. We have a heavy clay soil out here. And the comfrey can also be put into our compost pile. You can also take the comfrey and put it in buckets with water. It makes a fertilizer. So again, multi-purpose and multi-cropping and multicultural. It's kind of like we're recreating the Garden of Eden. You know, we have the apple, tree of knowledge, right? The idea, I think, biblically is a beautiful one of the Garden of Eden, is that that's what we want to see more of on the planet. We want to have a harmony and compatibility. To me, that's what permaculture is, a harmonious look at how we create our world. So permaculture is not just for gardening. Permaculture design is also for buildings, like green buildings. It's also looking at generating electricity from the sun, collecting your water. At home, I also do permaculture of collecting the rainwater from my roof. And then we do laundry to landscape. Each time I do laundry, it goes and irrigates the garden. And we have solar panels, that self-sufficiency. I think that's what Garden of Eden was too, is that God provides everything that we need to survive.
It comes into my mind every now and then about when we have extreme weather, which is getting more extreme. And I just think about when the Europeans came, it's like, well, we must have houses. When the natives probably knew how to work with those changes because of their inherent permaculture and understanding the land and having a relationship with the land, having a relationship with the weather, so that their housing was the earth. And so when there was an extreme, they probably knew how to deal with it better than we do now.
Yes, brilliant. He's right on the spot there again, that you're looking at your local resources. Indigenous people would call them their allies or their relatives. Beans, even the soil itself, can show you over in the Africa section. We try to recreate a mud or adobe house. Another term is called cob. So yeah, the whole thing is called natural building techniques. So building with the mud, the clay. You mix in sand and straw, and then you have cement. Next to us is a huge cement building, which has a huge carbon footprint. So that's another thing about permaculture. You're looking at your carbon footprint and you're trying to minimize that, use local resources. Like we have gotten a lot of used lumber here, salvaged lumber, freebies, people's leftover carpets I put down to keep the weeds down. The chips are free from the city, dumps them off here. It's a mindset. To me, permaculture is, you want it to permeate your thoughts. I've created this to be a community like park for people to go back to the Garden of Eden, to enjoy the nature and to see what is possible and what people could do in their own yard as well.
Can we go see Africa?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, look at this. This is your little dwelling.
Yeah, this would be a dwelling in Africa. They had them more circular than we were able to create here. But we created this from the earth. It is
Hey, kitty.
The clay soil, sand, and straw. And then you make it into these blobs and slap them together. And so this is a monolith. This is not adobe bricks. It's all melded together. When you bring over some of it, then everyone smears it with their hands. So this was a community project that took us a year, really. So we just dug pits of the clay soil, really heavy clays here, and added the sand and the straw, and layer by layer by layer. Cloudy lives in here.
The kitty.
The Cloudy the kitty. Yeah, he likes to hang out in here. And it's created as a playhouse for kids. And then we've had other groups come in and paint and decorate. It's a fun place to hang out. You could, you know, meditate and pray in here also. And a construction crew did this as a community project to build the roof. If you're building out of natural earth, you have to make sure that it has a good foundation, which is recycled, in our case, concrete. We call it urban crete that you just get from urban projects, that they're breaking up a sidewalk, for example, and then we got the concrete that way. And then it has to have a good roof too, so that it doesn't get wet. At least in Africa, they'll rebuild every few years. Okay. And that's also, you know, like barn raising, it's also a community project where everybody helps each other to build their houses, their dwellings, places. And they lived more, you know, communally. So that's another thing about permaculture. We're really looking to create a more community experience. People come out here and volunteer on Sundays and feel like they're part of it. Like in other countries, that a village.
Yeah.
Creating like a village. It's really tricky, actually, to grow some of the African crops. We have okra, I've tried. We're not really humid enough here. I've grown some of the squashes successfully. Some of the other things that are from Africa that you don't think of is watermelon and peanuts, sorghum. We had to rearrange this garden area a few times with the chicken coop in mind. There again, for self-reliance or subsistence living. I did spend some volunteer time in Africa, Liberia, West Africa, and people would have their own little chickens running around, and everybody would grow some green vegetables to throw into a pot with the chicken for a stew. Yeah, that's what you want to look at, is what can you grow to eat, including animals, and what can you grow for your herbs and for your teas. And ideally, this African plot would have a lot more in it than it does now. We could grow more grains from Africa. They're not only sorghum is from Africa, but so is teff that they use in Ethiopian cooking. And we have an Ethiopian restaurant here in town. We've gotten food from them for our potluck.
What's interesting about coming to the African section is our own history. All of the things that you have here, watermelon, peanuts, sorghum, okra, they're all staples of the African-American Southern diet.
Right. So that's what they did, is they brought them over with them from Africa and then cultivated them in the South. Yeah.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm learning about permaculture at our global family farm in San Luis Obispo. This is a consciously designed landscape which mimics the patterns and relationships found in nature while yielding an abundance of food, fiber, and energy for the provisions of local needs. And nearing the end of the tour, we discuss the beginnings of the project. So that's your hand-drawn design of this garden that you have. How long ago did you start this project?
2014.
How long did it take you to come up with this design?
We had permaculture design course. To get certified in permaculture, you have to design something. So I got a group of four women, and each of them had some ideas for each of the four quadrants. And then I took those ideas and kept developing them further.
What percentage of this original concept has come to fruition?
Well, the one thing that's come to fruition is that there's plants everywhere. I don't have all the many as I would like from Africa, for example, or Asia. We're in the Asia section now. There's a plethora. There's so many varieties of different Asian greens that I'm still trying to source seeds for. In Asia, things that we don't think of coming from Asia do, like cilantro. It's called Chinese parsley. Cucumbers, that's also from Asia. Basil is from Asia. There's this Japanese pepper, the shishito. That's where citrus originally came from, is China. And peaches and apricots and plums.
Have you read the book 1491 and 1493 by Charles Mann?
No.
1491 is about the ecosystem of the world before the Columbian Exchange, and 1493 is about how the ecosystem of the world changed during and after the Columbian Exchange. It blew my mind. It's a book that you should read. Well, I'll just say one thing. 70% of North America's flora and fauna has been eradicated off the earth.
There you go. This pattern of colonialism keeps repeating itself. I mean, that's another thing about permaculture is we look at decolonizing your brain and your thoughts and your words and your actions and have reciprocity in thinking again, like, well, what came before? Let's honor indigenous wisdom and not eradicate it. And it's so unfortunate that our society is not organized by these ethics. The three ethics is really what they call the triple bottom line. Earth would be the environment, and people care is social justice, and future care is equity, environment, and ecology. The history of agriculture in the United States, they came and logged and cut down trees all in the Midwest to plant corn and destroy waterways, and then you get things like drought and the Dust Bowl. Permaculture wants to reverse that, so we're always looking at how can we restore this land, replant with trees, replant the Garden of Eden so that everybody can thrive. A little natural building house surrounded by trees that help shelter it and buffer it and waterways and gardens. And so that's what I'm trying to create here.
Even if it doesn't look like what you drew 11 years ago, you've got an amazing thing going on here.
Thank you very much. Cuesta College has a class called Plants and People, and they're going to come out here for a tour. I come, yeah, that's exactly what this garden is people and plants. Plants and people. I want to see more of this, more permaculture, homesteading, more people growing what they can of some foods in their own backyards, and to have our farms look more like gardens, and then have your gardens look more like farms, have edible landscaping. So our future has to be regenerative. We can't just extract. That's the kind of society we have, especially in America, taking out, and you have to give back. And that's the society that we'd like to see in the future, and have more people have that frame of mind.
Our future needs to be regenerative, our farms to look more like gardens, and our gardens to look more like farms. Isn't that a wonderful vision of creation? And as trees put it, bring back the Garden of Eden right where we are, as if the Central Coast wasn't already perfect enough. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
Hello, this is Gianna Patchen, and welcome to the first ever segment of People and the Planet. People and the Planet highlights local environmental leaders and explores the interconnection between our communities and our Earth. To briefly introduce myself, my name is Gianna Patchen, and I'm the chapter coordinator for the Santa Lucia chapter of the Sierra Club, representing San Luis Obispo County. Our work strives to support all SLO County communities through environmental advocacy, education, community building, and legislative engagement. A caveat that People and the Planet's guests do not represent the Sierra Club. And with that, I'm excited to welcome my very first guests, local leaders from the San Luis Obispo Climate Coalition, Lexi Head, their operations and community engagement manager, and Carlos Hernandez, their home energy advising manager.
Hi, thanks for having us. As you had mentioned, I am Carlos Hernandez, SLO CC's Home Energy Advising Manager. We are a local nonprofit dedicated to championing high-impact climate solutions right here in our community. We have been working diligently the past several months, and I'm proud to say we have successfully launched our Home Energy Advising Program at the beginning of August, helping hard-to-reach audiences utilize rebates and incentives for electrification projects and improvements to their home.
And I'm Lexi Head, SLO Climate Coalition's Operations and Community Engagement Manager. I lead much of our community engagement, like tabling events, manage our College Corps Fellows, and take care of the behind-the-scenes work, like grant management and more.
Thank you both so much. You really do a lot here in our community to help connect community and climate work together. Could you share a little bit more about the SLO Climate Coalition's work and history that's brought you here today?
Absolutely. So SLO Climate Coalition actually began in 2012 as SLO Clean Energy. It was founded by community members to pursue local climate action, and its first major success was helping launch Community Choice Energy, which is now Central Coast Community Energy, or 3CE, which gave the region local control over cleaner, more affordable electricity. Then in 2017, the group evolved into the SLO Climate Coalition, expanding its focus to all aspects of climate action. So today, the coalition remains community-driven, centering its work on education, advocacy, and hands-on programs that empower residents to take meaningful action.
Wow, thank you so much, Lexi, for sharing that. So what are some of the programs that SLO Climate Coalition is working on here locally?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and start. So one of our main programs is our new home energy advising program. Our service is offering free personalized support to hard-to-reach clients in San Luis Obispo County, Santa Maria, and neighboring city residents interested in home electrification upgrades. The service provides one-on-one guidance through home evaluations, accessing rebates, and connecting you with trusted contractors that can significantly reduce the cost of electrifying your home, potentially bringing it close to zero net cost. And we work closely with the Green Transportation Program, as the programs are a little intertwined. But the Green Transportation team advocates for fossil fuel-free transportation and the infrastructure to support it. They provide information and resources to help you electrify your transportation. Our biggest events of the year are coming up on September 23rd, 25th, and 27th for National Drive Electric Month.
And the third program is Uniting the Central Coast for Action, which is our civic action arm of Slo Climate Coalition that encourages the Slo community to participate in local and state policy advocacy, attend city council meetings, and sign petitions to push for stronger climate action. We have many recorded educational webinars on our website, and our most recent three-part series being about offshore wind. We also host the Voices for Energy Justice podcast, where we uncover how climate justice initiatives are addressing systemic inequalities and forging a path towards a fair, more resilient future for all.
I know that these programs are really essential for helping support our local communities here. But of course, this work is forging towards the future to protect other people, to protect future generations. And there's some really important efforts that need to happen now to help protect future generations. I have heard that many of these electrification incentives are being rolled back by the Trump administration right now. Can you tell us upcoming deadlines so folks can take advantage of these programs before they're taken away?
Yeah, you've heard correctly. There have been recent federal policy changes that are rolling back many of the clean energy tax credits, which creates a sense of urgency for anyone looking to make these upgrades. To take advantage of these programs before they expire, here are the key deadlines you should know about. The electrical vehicle tax credit, which is a federal tax credit of up to $7,500 for new EVs and $4,000 for used EVs, is set to expire on September 30th, 2025. This is an extremely urgent deadline. And to qualify, you must have a binding purchase agreement in place by this date, though delivery can happen later. Residential clean energy credit, the tax credit for homeowners who install solar panels, heat pumps, battery storage, and other renewable energy systems, is scheduled to expire on December 31st, 2025. This credit is worth up to 30% of the cost of the system. And lastly, the energy efficient home improvement credit. The tax credit for upgrades like insulation, windows, doors, and certain heat pumps also expires on December 31st, 2025. This credit can provide up to $3,200 per year. Despite these federal rollbacks, there are still local and state programs we plan to utilize to continue offering our services for folks in the area.
It's really concerning to see how these rollbacks impact everyday people who are trying to make their home more cost-effective, with climate benefits sometimes as a secondary motivator for pursuing these incentives. So I really appreciate you highlighting those deadlines. I really encourage folks to reach out to the Slo Climate Coalition to learn more about these programs, see how they can help you make your next choices for your home and your car more cost effective, as well as good for the environment. If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas, and I'm your host, Gianna Patchen. Today, I'm talking to Lexi and Carlos of the San Luis Obispo Climate Coalition. So next, could you share just a little bit more about the Slo Climate Coalition's home energy advising program that we're encouraging folks to take advantage of right now?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, we provide a free home energy advising service to assist hard-to-reach audiences, which includes individuals enrolled in government assistance programs like Section 8, food stamps, Medi-Cal, and PG&E's care program, as well as non-English-speaking monolingual households. Our service begins with a home visit to understand a client's specific needs, priorities, and concerns regarding electrification projects. We then connect them with trusted contractors and manage the bidding process to ensure they receive fair and competitive pricing. Our goal is to create a tailored roadmap that maximizes energy savings through key electrification upgrades, such as heat pump HVAC systems, heat pump water heaters, induction stoves, solar, battery storage, and EV charging. As part of our program launch, we are excited to announce a free giveaway in partnership with Pacific Heating and Sheet Metal for a single head heat pump mini split system and installation. If anyone is interested in this service or interested in our giveaway, feel free to fill out our intake form at slowclimatecoalition.org/HEA by simply clicking on the giveaway flyer. And if you qualify for the giveaway but aren't necessarily qualified for the service, you can still be enrolled in the giveaway. So they're not exclusive to one another.
That's great to hear, Carlos. Thank you. And really amazing that y'all help walk people through this process and make sure that our community is getting a fair chance to upgrade our homes. Really encourage folks to check out that website. I'll say it again, slowclimatecoalition.org/HEA. You can also go to Slow Climate Coalition's website and you will find that resource. So right now we're in a moment where efforts to address the climate crisis are being attacked. We're seeing these electrification incentives, which are really a benefit for our communities to have cost-effective home upgrades, that are being rolled back. How are you seeing your work at the Slow Climate Coalition impacted by these particularly federal level rollbacks?
We've spoken a lot about the upcoming deadlines for electrification projects, but we're also just seeing a lot of uncertainty in the nonprofit world. Like for funding and grants, you almost can't trust that you will actually receive anything until it's in hand because there's this fear that it'll be taken away or canceled simply because of the federal government.
We're seeing a lot of uncertainty for so many of us right now, not only folks like us who work in the environmental sphere, but also for local communities, really emphasizing that a lot of these programs, like the electrification program, are crucial to help folks reduce their water and electricity and gas bills, right? To help plan for the future, to have safer indoor air quality, right?
Absolutely.
So this is really, really frustrating for me, at least, to see these opportunities for our local communities be taken away and impact our local nonprofits who are at the forefront of helping support our local communities here. So in that realm, I'm really curious how the both of you got involved in climate advocacy. Could you share more about your own personal stories?
Definitely. I've always been interested in climate action. Growing up in the Central Valley of California, I didn't get to pursue that very much. So when I moved here, I had a lot more exposure to that, which was really great. And a few years ago, I decided I really wanted to take the dive and learn more about climate action and climate change and just everything about that. And I was very fortunate to actually get a position with the Slow Climate Coalition. And through that, I've been able to meet so many local climate leaders and activists, and I feel like I've simply learned so much just from being around everyone.
Yeah, and then I've always personally been conscious of my daily actions, focusing on reducing waste, recycling, using my bicycle for transportation. I never really took it into the workplace, but thankfully with my current role at the Slow Climate Coalition, this marks my first proactive involvement in climate advocacy, shifting from individual efforts to a broader community-focused approach. So,
that's really wonderful. So we're nearing the end of our program. I am wondering if you all have any upcoming events that you'd like to share with us.
Yeah, so the Home Energy Advising Giveaway, as I mentioned, is open until the end of September. So to learn more about the service or the giveaway, we invite you to attend our information session at the San Luis Obispo Public Library on Tuesday, September 16th, or also visit our website, again, slowclimatecoalition.org/HEA. But additionally, we will be launching a web series on social media and YouTube in late October to provide more in-depth information about our services and the benefits of home electrification. This is going to be both short format on social media and long format on YouTube.
Yeah, and this month is actually National Drive Electric Month. And if you'd like more details, again, you can visit our website or our social media at Slow Climate Coalition.
And finally, our last question for the day. How can our listeners support the San Luis Obispo Climate Coalition?
Well, we love community support. We love to partner with local community members and other organizations that share similar values. We welcome volunteers either day to day or for events, like for National Drive Electric Month. And you can also donate to our website, or if you're part of an organization, then you can also sponsor us. And you can find all of that information on our website, slowclimatecoalition.org.
Thank you so much, Lexi and Carlos, for sharing your expertise and passion today. It is really such a joy to get to work alongside you And I really appreciate you being our first guests on People in the Planet. Thank you to all of our listeners. We really look forward to joining you once a month to talk about our local environment and how you can help protect people and the planet. That was Lexi and Carlos of the San Luis Obispo Climate Coalition talking to us about local climate solutions as well as opportunities for you to electrify your home and save money here in San Luis Obispo County.
Hi, my name is Tom Bowman. I'm a climate change communication consultant, and I'm also the author of several books on sustainability, most notably one titled, What If Solving the Climate Crisis is Simple?
Tom, thank you so much for joining us on Issues and Ideas today. It's great to have you here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Excited to be here.
Why don't you go ahead and give us a little history on yourself?
So I founded an exhibit design company in the late 1980s. We did air show exhibits, trade show exhibits, all the commercial marketing stuff that keeps a business afloat. But we also worked on energy centers for utility companies. These are permanent briefing centers that teach people how to save energy, be more efficient about lighting and building design, all that. And along the way, I was invited to lead a team that designed a science museum for the National Academy of Sciences in Washington, D.C. And because of that, I got an education on climate science from some of the most famous and notable climate scientists in the country. And what I learned in that experience sort of redirected my career path to work on climate communication.
Dive a little deeper there. What is climate communication and how does that translate to us?
It's a big bucket. Basically, what I realized is that nobody calls a design company in until they've already made too many plans. And I wanted to be able to broaden what I could offer because I didn't know at that time in the early 2000s, I didn't know very many creative communication people who really knew what the climate science was had to say about our future and where we were. And so I formed a consultancy, and as a result of that, I've done messaging for NASA, I've done advising for NOAA. We designed the U.S. pavilions for several of the COP conferences. I did a lot of exhibit design for the Aquarium of the Pacific in Long Beach, California, and some other aquariums, and did webinars, hosted a podcast, wrote books, gave a lot of speeches, and I actually implemented decarbonizing my design firm and discovered that it seemed really hard at first, but turned out to be incredibly easy to make huge savings.
Is there a way that you can cliff note that and tell me why it was so easy?
Yeah, it's actually quite simple. You know, most small companies own a car. The owner's car is often owned by their business because it just has a tax advantage. And so I traded a small SUV for a Prius, which was the lowest carbon car I could think of at the time. I also had our emissions measured by a third party called the Climate Registry. So we'd know as an experiment what was working. And along the way, by setting an impossible sounding goal, it caused us to reexamine everything we were doing. And so when the lease came due on our copier, we replaced it with a multifunction machine and we turned off every other machine in the building. We, you know, changed all our lights to LEDs. Our air conditioner broke down. We bought the most efficient one we could afford to buy to replace it. All those simple kind of incremental things just reduce waste that we were paying for and didn't realize. No, you know, nobody suffered. Life was not more difficult. Nobody was too hot. It's just that we weren't throwing money away every year on energy we didn't need to use.
And that was in the early 2000s where you kind of shifted your focus towards that. Bring us up to date. What's it been like since the early aughts up into 25 or 24?
For a while. So I set out on a mission. I had been trained in climate science by climate scientists. And the reason was that in order to create an exhibit for the rest of us, I had to understand what the science was saying well enough to simplify it without distorting it. So I read textbooks. I talked to climate scientists ad nauseum. I read papers. I really became part of that world as sort of a fifth wheel. And then I realized I needed to understand the social science this is much better. I needed to understand, I needed to talk to the people who were measuring public attitudes about climate change, and became sort of a colleague and co-author of some papers with them. And I started assembling teams of disparate, you know, one of the good things about being a consultant and a designer is that you're not part of anybody's professional stovepipe. You're always in between them. And so I started bringing educators and scientists and social scientists and economists together to talk about climate change in ways they hadn't ever done before. I, for example, was talking to the NOAA Climate Program Office, and we were confused by the findings of the public attitude researchers. So I said, well, what if we gather all those people who are doing that research together and we have a conversation with them and ask questions? He said, man, if you can get them to come, I'll provide the place to do it. And they all came. And so I was able to issue reports that they all blessed that led to new studies, because no one had ever asked the kinds of questions that a person like me would ask. So it's been kind of a follow your nose path. What I've learned in recent years is that money for climate communication has become very hard to find. And so more of the money is, you know, the philanthropic money is mostly going to projects that are tangible in terms of technology change and implementation. And I have found myself increasingly working with members of federal agencies on professional development work and writing case studies about their grantees and things of that nature.
Changing the light bulbs, changing the copy, or even changing your car, great steps. What else are we missing? What are some of those questions that you were alluding to?
The question that has nagged me forever is, if I learned about climate science and I became committed to creating a future that we would want to live in instead of the future we're headed toward if we don't do anything, why isn't everybody else? Because the public attitude research says that the majority of people in the United States now are worried, seriously worried about climate change. So why are they buying SUVs? Why aren't they converting their HVA systems at home to heat pumps? Why aren't they changing some of their consumer behavior? Why aren't they voting for candidates who say that they will implement climate policies? What's the rub? What's the disconnect? And, you know, I know all about the disinformation campaign waged by the fossil fuel industry to keep people dispirited, which is why I wrote the book, What If It's Actually Simple? And one of the things that has become most obvious is that we just don't talk about it enough. You know, very few people contact their elected representatives about climate change. And of all the people who say that they're concerned about it, only about 6% of us actually talk about it with our families and friends on a regular basis. And I think this is actually perhaps our biggest gap. Because if we were talking about it more, if we normalized it more, if we just broke the ice and we started talking about the hope we have to change, you know, the technology, we are in a position now to really bring climate change to a halt if we are serious about it. And that's only really happened in the last few years. But if we don't talk about it, no one will know what's happening. And so we won't create the social momentum that creates the expectations that we always follow that will help us all join the party, basically.
So more conversation is step one. More
is really, really, well, it's a really, really important thing to add to mm-hmm. what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And then how do you deal with, the corporations of today who are probably wasting billions of dollars in energy? How do we tackle that issue? We can get our Prius and we can change our light bulbs, which are all great, which especially here in California, it seems like everybody's on that.
On the corporate side, there's some interesting things happening. I know a guy named Andrew Winston who was the co-author of a book called Green to Gold, which was sort of a 2006 study about how some corporations were exceeding their environmental goals by years and by wide margins. And how did they do it? And I used that as a model for decarbonizing my little company. And Andrew Winston, one of the co-author of that book, said that, you know, things have really changed. You don't find people denying the reality of climate change in boardrooms anymore. They just can't do it because it's too obvious. And corporations are now required to disclose their climate risks to investors, and that is making a significant difference. The price of solar and battery storage and EVs has fallen so fast that in some ways the market is already shifting beyond the capacity of governments to prevent, right? Because the economics are now in favor of clean energy like they never were until now. I mean, literally the last couple of years. So the opportunity is really growing. As consumers, it's hard to educate yourself about which corporations are good sort of environmental citizens and which are not. There are the obvious brands, you know, the Patagonias of the world, the Clif Bar Company of the world, the Ben & Jerry's of the world, the companies that have sort of staked their brands on their environmental performance. Beyond that, it's very, very hard to tell. And so the way we can sort of respond is divest from fossil fuels in our retirement portfolios, any investments that we have. We can, and if you have a manager who does that stuff for you, like I do, you just say no fossil fuels and they say, okay, and that's that, you mm-hmm. know, it's that simple. Beyond that, when news arises and you hear about something, that would be the time to, in the way that, you know, Elon Musk has been a blessing and a curse, right? Mm-hmm. He Tesla led the way in making electric vehicles popular. Got to give him a lot of credit for doing that and making charging them along the roadway mm-hmm. easy.
Absolutely.
Right? And then he launched into the Doge world. And pissed everybody off. And consumers made their voices heard mm-hmm. in the same way they did with the Jimmy Kimmel firing. Mm-hmm. So those are opportunistic moments. It's hard to sustain that long term because you don't really know. It's hard to do that kind of research. And sure. I don't think it's very realistic. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What if solving the climate crisis is simple? Your book. Please tell me about your book.
So my book was a response. It's very short. And I was approached by a publisher who wanted to publish a series of short books in 2020 to 2022 timeframe during the pandemic that would ask the question, how can we come out of the pandemic and solve some of the world's biggest problems? And I was referred to him. He approached me about writing about climate change. And so the book is it's 100 pages and it's easy to read sort of summary of what the social science tells us, but also through my own eyes and my own experience mm-hmm. as a business person, as a creative professional, and as just a citizen of the world. And the reason for the title is that I realized along the way that we've been taught that climate change is an impossibly complicated problem to solve. That if you pull on any thread, you start pulling on things that that are far beyond your capacity to cope with. So for example, let's say you wanted to decarbonize the food supply. You know, so now you're into agriculture and how you do pesticides and herbicides, which are all made of fossil fuels for the most part. And you're into transportation because food is a global system, and you're suddenly involved in international finance and energy management and water management and water rights in California where we live and all this stuff. And it becomes an overwhelming bunch of interacting, complicated systems. Mm-hmm. Scientists like to call that a wicked problem. And what they mean by a wicked problem is you can't even define it well enough to solve it. So the best you can do is try to manage it as best you can and take your lumps along the way. I can't think of a more dispiriting message to mm-hmm. give to people, right? Mm-hmm. The problem for us is that all of the climate communication stemmed from the science community. And that was appropriate, right? They had to tell us what they were finding. These are people who study all those complicated systems. So naturally, they tell you about all those complicated systems. And so it creates the impression that this is a really, really complicated problem to solve because it's impossible to create a master plan for something mm-hmm. global, sure. right? And it turns out we don't need to. So I had an art professor in college. I was in a painting class and I was struggling with the painting. I couldn't make it work. Everything I tried failed. You know, I was just getting frustrated. And he said, I'll tell you what you do. Hang it on the wall upside down and go home. And I did. And when you come back the next day, when it's upside down, you see it completely differently, and you immediately know what's wrong, right? Mm-hmm. Well, I sort of generalized that in my design business to any problem, right? What does it mean to hang it upside down? It means if all of your solutions are failing, try to figure out if there's a specification or an assumption or a guidepost or some goal that is consistent in every failure. And the more rock solid it seems, the more useful it is to set aside. Because when you set that aside, all of a sudden possibilities become available to you that you never saw. And it works like a charm. So when I thought about the wicked problem, I thought, man, that is an absolutely perfect assumption to set aside. What happens when you set it aside? Well, the answer to the climate crisis is one sort of catchphrase I came up with in the book, which is stop burning fossil fuels well before mid-century and absolutely positively do not fail. Mm-hmm. Now, with that formulation, that's amenable to every, I mean, that's accessible to everybody, right? In your business, in your personal life, in your interactions with your neighbors, in your voting life, everything you do, you can just reduce, you can stop burning so much fossil fuel. It has to do with what you drive, how you move around, how much time you spend going places versus having online conversations like we're having, mm-hmm. And on and on and on. And that just unlocks things. And so then the book explores how that works.
Does the thought of AI come into your mind at all as far as what it's going to take to run these things and cool these things?
Yeah. So as I'm sure you know, AI runs on huge data centers, right? And huge data centers have been cropping up all over the place anyway because of the technology revolution. So, and they are energy intensive places. Most of them are built with lots of air conditioning because the servers get hot. And so you have to vent that air out and you have to cool them down and you have to run them. So they're huge energy hogs. I happen to have done a lot of work with Southern California Edison on energy efficiency over the years. And one of their projects was to build a new data center. And they thought they were going to give tours of it. And then they decided it's really going to be their data center, so they can't let anybody know where it is. Mm-hmm. But they put it in a hot location with no air conditioning, because they wanted to demonstrate that the technology exists at very low energy cost to keep them cool enough to operate effectively. So there's that. Secondly, the price of solar is and battery storage is getting so cheap that the big, you know, the Googles and the Apples are committing themselves to running data centers on renewable energy. And this is part of our move to electrify literally everything and do it with renewable resources that is happening, you know, we haven't gone anywhere near far enough, but it's happening. It's accelerating right now. And they're finding that you actually use less total energy than when you run those places off of coal-fired or gas-fired power plants. So on the one hand, it looks like a big, bad move. And on the other hand, if it can be done sustainably, then you'll never even know. You'll never notice.
In comparison to the individual versus the corporation, again, the AIs, the Apples, the big ones out there, is everyone in an upward trajectory, as in we're all kind of changing the light bulbs and putting on solar? Is that the way it's trending?
I think there are two trends. One trend is that global emissions continue to rise, and that's really, really bad news. I mean, really bad news, because this is the decade that really counts, mm-hmm. and we're halfway through it. The really good news is that there's a narrative about the rapid pace of change that has never been expressed as a narrative. You know, when you decarbonize your small company and you publish about it and you try to encourage others, politicians give you a pat on the head and news people treat you like it's a curious anecdote, but it's not important because you're not big enough. Mm-hmm. And it hasn't occurred to the media or to funders of communication campaigns to create a narrative about all that is changing. Mm-hmm. Because what's happening kind of under the radar is what happens when lots of people decide to solve a problem. right? It's like there is no master plan. There never will be, and there doesn't have to be. What there has to be is an ant farm of constant activity everywhere that's diffused and spreading and people sharing what they know, and that it generates a sort of a snowball effect, right? That's happening. It's happening below our awareness unless we really make the effort to find out about it. And so we're in a race. Published an article in the New Yorker, I think it was the New Yorker, recently that said, you know, the world is adding something like multiple gigawatts of solar every day now. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much happening in the United States. It's happening in Pakistan, where farmers are buying cheap Chinese solar panels and doing DIY installations to run the pumps, the water pumps to irrigate their fields. And they're just laying the panels on the ground. Mm-hmm. They're just doing it. Mm-hmm. And they've cut diesel use in that country by 40% by doing that, right? And Texas is now, maybe the biggest, or maybe it's California. I mean, we're sort of neck and neck in terms of renewable energy production because it just makes sense. It's mm-hmm. just cost effective. As that takes off, you know, that's real momentum, because 10 years ago, there was very little of any of this going on.
It seems like we just need more conversation. We need more people. We need more voices like yourself saying that these changes are happening, and it is happening maybe under the radar, but let's get it onto the radar.
Let's get it onto the radar. We need to create narratives that start to pull these threads together and say, this is what it looks like when humanity is working on a problem.
That's so great. Tom, thank you so much for joining us today here on Issues and Ideas. And again, you can catch Tom at the Bioneers Conference October 3rd, coming up here in San Luis Obispo at the Octagon Barn. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Our theme music comes from Gary Eister, and a big thank you to all of our guests and contributors. I'm David McAbee. Join me every Monday from 1 to 2 for more stories, more voices, and more of what makes our community tick. And if you miss something or just want to hear it again, you'll find every conversation waiting for you at kcbx.org. And remember, the best stories are right here at home. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week. This is KCBX.